read and hear more about important news, events, and public policy debates at ncnewsline.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Few public institutions in North Carolina have been at the epicenter of more highly charged political debate and controversy in recent years than the UNC system. Since Republicans took control of the legislature at the beginning of the last decade, they've systematically removed almost all Democrats from university governance, relieved the governor's office of its higher ed appointment powers, forced the ouster of two system presidents deemed insufficiently obedient, and sought repeatedly to micromanage the details of campus life, from curricula to faculty hiring to when and if schools would open during COVID. One figure, however, who seems to have found a way to thrive in this contentious environment is current system president Peter Hans. To hear critics describe the situation, Hans gets on well with the board and the legislature because he's willing to do their bidding. And indeed, in many instances, that's an assessment that's hard to deny. That said, Hans has actually increased his own authority since taking office, and as you'll hear in the following special extended conversation we recorded recently, he's someone who publicly expresses a desire to build bridges and find common ground.
Well, President Peter Hans, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Rob. I appreciate it very much.
So set the stage for our listeners and talk to us a little bit about, you've been in this job for a while now. Talk to us about the state of the UNC system, the size and scope of the system. It's a massive undertaking that you oversee.
Indeed it is. It's a joyful responsibility, but one that weighs on my shoulders occasionally because it's so important to the people of North Carolina. And I am so fortunate to be the seventh president of the university and following in the footsteps of some real giants. And I try to learn from their example and apply it to today's interesting environment. But so coming up on 4 years in the job this summer, it's been an eventful period of time. But to me, Rob, the most important takeaway, and I have to remind myself about this occasionally, is that North Carolina is really the best place in the country to be a college student. We've got this incredibly low tuition, very affordable, flat for 8 years in a row in state undergraduates. No other state in the country can claim that record. We've got an incredibly strong financial aid program. We've just launched the Next NC scholarship through the State Education Assistance Authority, which is also under the UNC system umbrella, that will help university and community college students with a simplified aid program. It's kind of bipartisan public policy that I love working on. We've actually got falling student debt in the UNC system, rising graduation rates, a remarkable diversity of institutions amongst our 17. From liberal arts and sciences to five HBCUs to major research universities and everything in between. And our students are graduating into a very vibrant, fast-growing state. And so what a privilege to be a small part of that.
Am I right that it's almost more than two-thirds of undergrad students actually get financial aid, despite the fact that we've been able to keep tuition flat for a while?
That's right. That's right. Of course, tuition and fees are a major component of the cost of higher education, but not the only one. There's housing and meals and books. And so we're trying to address each facet of the total cost of attendance, because not only is high quality, accessible, affordable education a constitutional commitment in North Carolina, it's our moral obligation as well. And so that requires our vigilance.
Of course, same time we talk about affordability, the reality is that some schools are facing some challenges. We've had demographic changes where we may have some enrollment challenges for some schools. And thinking about UNCG and UNC Asheville, been very public about some of these issues. Is there anything that can be done about that? Or is that we're just going to have to figure out how to deal with a different demographic environment in which we exist?
Rob, I started talking about this quite a bit in 2021 when it became clear that the effect of the birth rate was going to affect enrollment. That's more than my theory. That's the birth rate. So we can count on that. Now, North Carolina continues to attract people to our state, and I've pushed to raise the out-of-state admissions. because I think that's bringing talent to North Carolina. It's bringing students to North Carolina. They often settle here and contribute to our economy and our culture in very positive ways. So, you know, we have some strategies in place to address it. But the other factor here is, of course, a declining appeal of higher education itself. It's been under attack from various quarters, and people questioning whether or not it costs too much and delivers too little. And because our tuition and fees are so low, intentionally low, and well supported by the taxpayers and the citizens of the state, we want to demonstrate the value that comes with a college education at the same time. So that's a strategy that's going to play out over the years that our birth rate is affecting us. And of course, also to attract more working adults. This has been a major focus of mine. The UNC system hasn't had to spend as much time on this over the past few decades because we've had this rising number of the traditional college-going demographic, 18 to 24-year-olds. And so adults who needed to finish off a college degree or add a college degree or perhaps develop new skills because of the fast-changing economy really went to out-of-state providers for four-year credentials. Some good actors in that space, but there's some bad actors in that space, Rob, that really sign you up for big loans, provide low-value credential. And I want the UNC system to be able to do good and do well at the same time, to meet those needs and yet address our enrollment challenges at the same time.
Is there any possibility of consolidation? I know we're having some program cuts at some schools. Is that a, could we even see campus consolidation at some point? Is that?
I don't see that on the horizon. You know, that's one of those things that rarely yield the savings that people might think. Are there some back office functions that could be combined where nobody could tell the difference of, you know, hey, we've got some HR people performing duties at multiple campuses so that you had specialists in particular fields? You know, that sort of thing I think we ought to look at, because if we could help campuses find their niche and reinvest any savings from something like that into the academic core, then that's what we should do. I mean, we need to be as streamlined and run as efficiently as possible. But I don't see any campus consolidation in the picture now.
We're talking with Peter Hans, who's the president of the University of North Carolina system, about a lot of things. I want to talk to you about a subject that's come up more and more lately, and that's return on investment. This is this new idea that we're going to be looking at, it's really the earnings of people after they leave college and university, and then using that, I guess, as a measurement for how well the schools are doing. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. I know that's controversial in some circles. Some folks are afraid that, you know, there's a lot of great careers out there that maybe aren't, maybe like journalism, that aren't necessarily that well paying, and or maybe people go out of state to earn money. What, talk to us about this term ROI.
I wonder what. Right, that's right. And there are great careers, journalism, I think teaching being an even a more clear example of the fact that there's more to life than money. We know there are any number of programs with deep cultural societal value beyond our earnings. And so we're looking at how to increase the value of all of those programs for our students. I mean, you should study what you love and have confidence in that. For instance, the ROI study that we did, it was requested by the legislature. We conducted it with Deloitte, showed that English majors did quite well. And I think to show that our students have had substantial socioeconomic mobility as a result of earning a college degree, really, to me, the headline out of the study was higher education does provide value for the people in North Carolina and the students who experience it. Yes, in terms of career paths, because students and families are understandably interested in where they study and what they study, what that might lead to. But trying to keep that larger picture in mind about higher education is important to the economy, but also our democracy and our culture as well.
I mean, I could envision there being political pressure. Like, the kids from this department, they're not doing well. Why are we teaching them that? I mean, are you have any concerns in that direction?
So that really has not been the primary feedback that we've gotten about those programs identified, which showed a low return. It has been more focused on, okay, how do we take those programs and elevate them? Do we lower the price of those programs? How do we add some career paths, integrate them into the curriculum so that might be more closely aligned? But I'll say this, Rob, you know, as someone who holds a liberal arts undergraduate degree and a liberal arts master's degree, then I didn't go into my field of study either. I think that's a common experience. So much of college is learning about yourself and
learning how to learn.
The growth. Yes, how to learn so that we're prepared. Realizing so many of the jobs of the future don't even exist yet. And the current jobs that are here now may well change or evolve or even go away.
Coming up next, part two of my conversation with UNC System President Peter Hans. Don't go away.
Read and hear more about important news, events, and public policy debates at ncnewsline.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. In part one of my recent extended conversation with University of North Carolina System President Peter Hans, we discussed some of the successes UNC campuses have had in keeping tuition and fees relatively affordable, while also dealing with some of the tough realities posed by shifting demographics that have lowered the number of college applicants seeking enrollment across the U.S. and forced some schools to make cuts to programming. In part two of our conversation, we explored some of the more controversial topics that have been front and center during Hans's tenure in office, including the micromanagement of university affairs and chancellor searches by politicians and their appointees, the lack of diversity on the system board of governors, the recent decision to prohibit schools from switching athletic conferences without board of governors' approval, and the threat posed to student well-being by the legalization of online gambling and a growing array of social media apps.
Another interesting development lately, of course, has to do with switching athletic conferences. The board voted to give itself control over that. Well, I guess in the past, schools have basically been able to leave the conference they're in. There's so much tumult and turnover in the world of college sports these days. I wonder what your thoughts are on that and whether you've gotten any pushback from individual chancellors or campuses.
Yeah. Well, so I think the system has wisely delegated athletics to the campuses for many decades because we would do very little else here if we were trying to manage the athletic end of the enterprise from the system office. But we've traditionally had a role to play in approving athletic fees for students or athletic facilities or various personnel contracts that qualify under our policy. So there has been a role. But what has happened, and you referenced it, tremendous change in the landscape of college sports over the past few decades. It's almost unrecognizable
right.
to an old timer like you and me, Rob.
You and me, yeah.
That over the past 10 years, we've actually had seven schools within the system change athletic conferences. Wow. Two of those changed twice. And they all had their reasons for doing so. And of course, athletics brings a lot to a campus. You know, it engages alumni. It, you know, enhances the student experience. It's very positive in so many respects, but we have to stay focused on the core mission. So if we get into this arms race about spending on athletics, we're not going to be Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, and Michigan in college football. We've got to focus on the strength of the academic core and not lose sight of that mission. So that's behind the idea that somebody needs to bless the financial decision, the impact of changing these conferences. It was obviously stimulated by the conversations surrounding the ACC. You know, Rob, when you get into thinking about what if a state and or Carolina were to leave the ACC, there's an exit fee of approximately $140 million. You'd have to buy your way out of the grant of rights, hundreds of millions of dollars. Then you'd have to upgrade facilities, hire more coaches, pay more players, et cetera. it quickly becomes out of control. And so any decisions that have to be made have to remain focused on what enhances the academic mission of the university. And I'm confident this will help us to do so.
Speaking of sports and lots of money, sports betting now coming to North Carolina. And I wonder, the studies I've seen say that young men in particular, like young college age men, are among the most vulnerable to this. I personally have a lot of concerns about what that's going to mean, and that it could be a very predatory and seductive thing. We got the ACC tournament coming up as we record this, and it's going to be opening up just in time for that. I wonder if you have any, share any of those concerns about what it could mean for our college students.
Oh, I'm worried too, Rob. I was a young man once too, and impulsive and not always thinking as clearly as perhaps I do in old age now. On one hand, the universities and their athletic programs are going to benefit from the sports gaming. Outside of Carolina and State, actually 13 of our universities will. School of Arts, of course, does not offer athletic programs at that level, but 13 of our campuses are going to benefit from some of the revenue there. So that's a positive, because that lessens the reliance on student athletic fees, which are very high at those 13 campuses. And you have students who are interested in sports and students who aren't interested in sports. So, you know, keep the fees low. But I am concerned that there are some number of people. Every bit of data we have about gambling shows that some small number of people will become compulsive. This was a great concern about the lottery back in the day. And we've gone from years of debating lottery to talking about casinos and sports gambling and all this. So it's a brave new world. I'm not convinced all this is for the positive in terms of societal impact. I am concerned about our college students, particularly when they spend so much time, an inordinate amount of time, on screens. They're used to video, social media, et cetera. They're advertising a great deal through that. Trying to engage our student health professionals, student life professionals, as to what we can do to work with the state's lottery commission and their existing programs about avoiding compulsive gambling. That sort of thing. But I don't have an answer, and I am worried about it.
We're talking with Peter Hans, who's the president of the University of North Carolina system. In the time we have remaining, I want to shift to the topic that's raised a bit of controversy over the years, certainly during your tenure, and that's sort of the role of the UNC Board of Governors in sort of getting down into the weeds and micromanaging what's going on our campuses, and right down to the level of mandating certain courses to be offered, and maybe which kind of professors or who should be tenured, and we're even going to have a new school at UNC Chapel Hill. This is both the board and the, of course, with the legislature's involvement. That's a change, is it not? And what does that mean? I know there's a lot of faculty members and alumni and even some chancellors who've been a little concerned about it.
So oh, sure. And I talk to them regularly about this. I would say, Rob, I think conflict is normal at a public university. I always say, on a day that policymakers and the public aren't arguing about higher education, that's the day I'm going to worry, because disagreeing is not the same as attacking. From the earliest days of the university, really, people have had different visions and different priorities. But I take that as a sign of devotion. I mean, these are people who care about the university. They may have very different views of how to get there and what they want to achieve. But I think when we consider the polarized era where we're living in, we should expect to see deep disagreements on our campuses. And of course, we're meant to host debates, not settle them. But as a public university, public oversight is a source of strength. It's not a problem in my view, although ask me on the wrong day, maybe I'd give you a different answer. But universities have a special role, and that comes with a lot of autonomy. But I think it's absolutely a good thing that public universities are in conversation with policymakers and the public all the time. It helps us keep public trust, earn broad support, and stay relevant to the people we serve. So I take all of that input for what it is and try to separate what could be interference from legitimately voicing an opinion about the university.
You know more about it than me, but my impression is that in other states, there may be even more direct involvement from lawmakers and governors and legislators in what campuses are doing. Can it get to a point where there's too much? I mean, do you have any concerns we could get to the point where, come on, guys, let us do our job here. We don't need the General Assembly micromanaging every course that's taught.
Yeah, it's constantly striving to achieve that balance of public interest. But yes, when I talk to my colleagues across the country, there's nothing unique about North Carolina in this sense. I think it's we're a reflection of where American society is right now. I think we Americans would argue about what day of the week it was. And it's just kind of where we are.
Well, another precedent that's sort of changed in, it seems, in recent years is this idea of putting political appointees from the Board of Governors itself into chancellor positions. We've had Carol Allison, Lee Roberts now as the interim at UNC Chapel Hill. Traditionally, when we've hired chancellors, it's been a national search for the best, highest profile person in public education that we can find. Do you have any concerns that this is sort of sending the message out there that UNC is sort of changing and how it hires the people to run its campuses?
Well, and that's exactly what we're going to have at Chapel Hill, a national open search. I've appointed a search committee. It's chaired by a member of the faculty, Dr. Christy Page, who's the dean of the medical school, remarkable leader. And we have other representatives of the faculty, the staff, the students, alumni, trustees. And we have a unified process then. So I feel good about that. My phone has been ringing with national leaders who are interested in coming to North Carolina because they see the statistics. We're in the top five in the country on a per capita basis in funding higher education. And we're really only behind Massachusetts and California in that regard because Alaska and Wyoming technically qualify with us, but it's not comparable. We're behind Massachusetts and California, essentially. And so they see this strong public support on a bipartisan basis for the university. And yes, we have Republicans and Democrats arguing about various things at the university. But again, that's taking place everywhere across the country. Now, I do think the role of chancellor has evolved a little bit over the years. These are sprawling enterprises. There's very little time for a chancellor to be in the classroom. They're managing the operations of this enterprise. They're raising money. They're engaging with stakeholders of various sorts. So I think we have many examples of academics who have been extraordinarily successful as chancellor. Randy Woodson, Harold Martin, on and on. But the chancellors I've appointed thus far or nominated to the Board of Governors for approval, Dr. Philip Rogers at ECU has national higher education experience. Dr. Aswani Valetti at UNC Wilmington is a renowned marine scientist. Dr. Kimberly Van Noort is a French literature teacher at UNC Asheville. Daryl Allison at Fayetteville State is the exception to that. Now, their board of trustees sent me five names, and it was four academics and Daryl Allison. And I had to think about, okay, here you have a historically underfunded HBCU.
Right.
And who can move the needle in that regard for FSU? Because there was a crying need to resource their programs and their campus and their facilities. And Chancellor Allison has accomplished exactly that. He's brought in a historic level of investment there and been successful in advocating for FSU to be added to the NC Promise program, which, as you know, is $500 a semester tuition. So, yes, he doesn't have the academic background, but he's been able to move the needle on funding, on partnerships with the military, community colleges, and others. So I think each campus is different. The needs of each campus are different, and thus the chancellor profile may differ a little bit over the coming years.
Speaking of that issue and sort of racial diversity and HBCUs, one issue that seems, from my perspective, to continue to be a bit of a challenge for the Board of Governors is it's still a pretty monochromatic group. It doesn't really sort of reflect the system's gender, race, ethnicity, political affiliation, even geography, when you come to who's on the board of governors, you know, there's this commission that the governor set up to look at this, and they've made some recommendations that we should maybe make some tweaks to that, maybe to try to make it a more representative group, but that seems maybe not to be going very far, very fast. I wonder if you have any thoughts on whether you wish there was a little bit better representation of different communities on the board.
Oh, sure. Yes. I will say, though, of course, the makeup of the Board of Governors is quite literally above my pay grade. And so probably not prudent for me to weigh in or at least be careful about it. I think a number of thoughtful adjustments to governance have been proposed and some accepted over the years. And the commission is certainly an example of that. And again, I can understand why some people would agree and some people would disagree. I think it's less about what the structure is, what the process is, than the people who are participating in it. And if they share a civic spirit of understanding the history of this remarkable public university system that's been built and a vision for how we need to move forward to meet North Carolina's needs and take care of those students and grow in the process, I think we can get there. It doesn't mean everybody's going to agree all the time. That's pretty much a given that we're going to disagree. But I think as long as you keep that commitment to the mission close to our hearts, we're going to be okay. In fact, I see it in our faculty, staff, and students every day. Every day when I get down about, well, we're arguing about this, or we're having a problem with that, just engage with these amazing faculty members and these super bright students. All this critique of Gen Z, it seems completely at odds with what I'm seeing when I interact with students. So that gives me hope that we'll ride through any governance questions we may have along the way.
We're coming to the end of our time with Peter Hans, who's the president of the UNC system, and it's a natural segue from talking about Gen Z to there was recently a speech you gave in which you talked about Yik Yak and SideChat, yeah. these apps that are on folks' phones that kids are using and you have concerns about, and maybe there might be a move. It doesn't sound like we can go too far to ban them, but maybe.
Right.
Is there a reasoning? Tell people what the concern is there. And
thank you.
Might could take.
Thank you for asking about this, Rob. I became aware of these hyper-local anonymous apps that operate within a 5-mile radius of the school only recently because, of course, I'm not on these apps. I'd never heard of them. But, yeah, they're SideChat, Fizz, Whisper, Yik Yak. And there's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of memes. But there's also a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of trolling. And my concern was student mental health because it's sort of the modern digital equivalent of scrawling nasty rumors on the bathroom wall. I mean, you can just say anything about anybody. There's no moderation whatsoever. And it's not good for students. It's not healthy. And so we are blocking that particular category of apps from our campus Wi-Fi. Now, students will still be able to access these through their data plans. So I'm under no illusions we're going to solve great problems here. But I think over time, we're going to look back and say the advent of the smartphone and apps is absolutely correlated with an increase in young people's anxiety and depression when they're spending 8 to 10 hours a day on screens, less time interacting with their peers, less time outside, less time reading books and, you know, all these more traditional time-tested ways of learning and growing. I think we're going to look back and say, we should have done more. So this is in some ways a symbolic step, but even if we can reduce their usage 10 or 20%, that's a step in the right direction. I'm trying to make a statement. I'm trying to spark some debate here as well.
Well, as you say, debate will always be a constant on the UNC system campuses. We know you're in the epicenter of an awful lot of it, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us to explore at least some of these issues today. Thank you for your time. And
thank you, Rob. I appreciate it very much.
Hope very much we can do it again soon.
Likewise.
Coming up next, we'll talk more about the advent of legalized sports gambling in North Carolina with an ECU professor who's created a new center to study the risks. Stay with us.